Right, hi everyone. We're back again with GRG. I think the timetable should settle down a bit now. There's been a lot of changes. Not entirely due to me, there's been others guilty as well, a bit of last minute changes in the schedule. The way things have worked out then, actually, the first three lectures have been on consecutive Wednesdays, which, as I said last time, is maybe no bad thing anyway, because it means it's spaced out the delivery of this. There was one year, I think it was the last time GRG ran, that's like Ewan Bennett, Laura Porter's year, where circumstances meant that I had to have one 3-hour lecture, which was a bit inhuman for me as well as them. So I think we've managed to avoid that, and it should roughly run at the pattern of one lecture per week for the remainder of the semester. Okay, so where we'd got to was the end of chapter 2, and we're just now ready then to begin exploring the consequences, the astrophysical consequences of the derivation of the Schwarzschild metric. So we hinted at the very first of those in the final page that we looked at before stopping. We had derived the metric really more or less from sort of first principles, just going all the way from Einstein's equations, the Ricci tensor components, and then applying a little bit of physics, the relevant boundary conditions, to solve the equations. And this is what we come up with. We come up with a metric that looks like Minkowski space-time. If you're far away from the origin, and at the origin there's this mass M, capital M, so we would apply this to something like a star, to the exterior metric outside a star. And it's clear, however, and this is what I stopped with last time, that funny things begin to happen when small r, the coordinate radius, is less than 2m. And that would mean that you're inside the event horizon. And we'll return to those strange things in chapter 6, which is where we look at black holes. But for the moment, we're going to consider our own star, the Sun, where that problem doesn't arise. The Schwarzschild radius of the Sun is about 3 kilometres, which is deep inside the Sun anyway, where it would be inappropriate to apply the Schwarzschild metric, because we assumed exterior to the star space-time is empty. Well, exterior to the Schwarzschild radius space-time isn't empty, you're inside the Sun. So chapter 4, we'll look at that, we'll look at the metric for the interior of a star. For now, however, for the next few lectures, we're going to concentrate on the metric exterior to a star like the Sun, and we're going to look at some classical tests of general relativity and how they helped to convince people that GR was right in the first place. Okay, so has anyone got any questions they'd like to ask from last week's stuff or from the previous week before we start? Alright then. So I'll start off with the first of the classical tests, which is the advance of the pericenter of planetary and stellar orbits. So what we're going to do is we're going to derive that result. We're going to demonstrate that instead of the Newtonian solution, which would be an elliptical orbit, that you wind up with a precessing ellipse, an ellipse which moves around in its line of pericenter. That's the line connecting the two objects. So it's quite a lot of math, but that's the way things are in a course like GRG. But I'll lead you through it. There's certainly no tensors anymore, because having derived the Schwarzschild metric, we can now just work from that by solving the geodesic equation, and we'll just do it in component form, so we don't need to use any heavy duty tensor calculus anymore. But I also want to set this in the context of not just the historical bit of physics, which was the experiment that Eddington conducted to see the deflection of light close to the Sun, but also much more modern ideas to do with the light deflection and the advance of pericenter for supermassive black holes, and also for neutron stars, two examples where there's really excellent evidence that the GR solution is in fact the correct one. Okay, but we've got to derive the results first of all, so that's where we'll begin. Okay, so in chapter 2, one of the equations we gave you there, 213, was a different form for the geodesic differential equation, slightly different from the one that Norman would have given you. I mean, maybe he gave you this one as well, I can't remember. But I showed in chapter 2 that you could write the more normal geodesic differential equation. That's the one that looks like d2x lambda by d tau squared plus gamma lambda alpha beta dx by d alpha by d tau dx beta by d tau equals 0. Okay, it's maybe a bit hard to read with the lights off, but that's the geodesic differential equation, which could be rewritten in the form of equation 3.1 by making some substitutions, and the substitutions really are just to replace gamma by the expression that involves the partial derivatives of the metric. So equation 3.1 emerges from doing that algebra, and in the example sheets you're taken through that. Now we're going to use that expression to see how we can derive the equations of motion for a test mass in the Schwarzschild metric. Okay, now the first thing to notice is that in equation 246, that's the Schwarzschild metric. So let's just go back and look at that. 246, the last equation in the previous chapter, which we had up a moment ago, the metric coefficients are that one minus 1 minus 2m over r, plus 1 over 1 minus 2m over r squared, and r squared sine squared theta. So those metric coefficients don't depend on t. Well, we know that because it's a static metric, so the metric coefficients shouldn't depend on t. We also know that the metric coefficients we see by looking at the equations don't depend on phi. Now the reason why that's helpful is if you look at the second term of equation 3.1, you've got d by dx lambda of g mu nu. So if lambda, or x lambda, is the coordinate that we associate with the label phi, or it's the coordinate that we associate with the label t, then in both cases that second term is going to be zero, because none of the metric coefficients, whatever mu and nu are, depend on t or depend on phi. So that partial derivative is always going to be zero. Okay? Therefore, if we set lambda equals zero and lambda equals 3, that's corresponding to the t case and the phi case respectively, then the second term on the left-hand side of that equation 3.1 is going to vanish. And given also that the Schwarzschild metric's orthogonal, if we look at the term inside the bracket of the first term, that's g lambda nu times dx nu by dp. Now nu appears in both the first and second terms, lower and upper indices, so you're summing over nu. Okay? But because it's an orthogonal metric, g lambda nu is only going to be non-zero if nu equals lambda. Okay? Because all the other terms would be off-diagonal. Therefore, if we're going to take lambda equals zero as our first case, that's we're associating lambda with the label t, then actually equation 3.1 reduces to what you see in equation 3.2. d by d tau of gtt times dt by d tau equals d by d tau of g lambda lambda d phi by d tau. They both have to equal zero, because in both of those cases the second term on the left-hand side of 3.1 is zero, we've already decided, okay? So we've got two equations already that we can trivially integrate because they're just differential equations of first order and they're both equal to zero. So gtt times dt by d tau has to be constant, and g phi phi times d phi by d tau has to be constant, okay? Now the geodesic differential equation for theta, that's what we get if we put lambda equals 2, and you can check for yourself that that produces equation 3.5, which then, when you do the chain rule differentiation of the first term, tidy up the algebra a little bit, comes down to 3.6. So we've got r squared d2 theta by d tau squared plus 2r dr by d tau d theta by d tau minus r squared sine squared, r squared sine theta cos theta d phi by d tau all squared. That all has to equal zero. Now, we can make our life a lot simpler emphasising again that GR applies in any coordinate system, but some coordinate systems are an awful lot easier to work with than others, if we choose a coordinate system in which theta is equal to pi by 2. Because that means that this term, the last term on the left-hand side, is always going to be 0, because cos theta is 0 for pi by 2. And in fact, the second term is also going to be 0, because if theta is a constant, then d theta by d tau is also 0. Okay? So d theta by d tau is 0. And actually all we're doing by making this choice of coordinate system is setting what the plane of our orbit is. But the fact that we can do that, the fact that we can look at equation 3.6 and recognise that theta equals pi by 2 is a particular solution of that equation, establishes that the GR solution still keeps the star and the planet in a plane. Now that doesn't necessarily follow. I mean, in Newtonian theory, it's because the force, the gravitational force, is directed along the line between the star and the planet. So there's nothing to introduce a third dimension. There has to be a plane for the orbit. But, you know, when you start out developing GR, I mean, I'm not aware of any sort of fundamental reason why the GR solution has to also have that property. But it does. So it's still a planar solution. The star and the planet will still follow an orbit which stays in the plane. The question is, will it just be an ellipse or will it be different? Well, that's what we're going to see. But because we're assuming theta equals pi by 2, it allows us to simplify the other equations. So I'll just remind you what 3.3 and 3.4 are. So we've got dt by d tau, d phi by d tau, gtt, and g phi phi. Well, it's just really the g phi phi that this applies to, is g phi phi is r squared sine squared theta. So if theta is pi by 2, then sine squared theta is 1. Therefore, we just get that d phi by dt is equal to h over r squared. So h is our constant. The reason why we've called it h, you'll kind of see in a minute. And dt by d tau times gtt, it was constant. So that relates to dt by d tau is a constant, which we call k, divided by 1 minus 2m over r. Okay? So, we've got three equations. We've got one for d theta by d tau, which is just that d theta by d tau is 0. We've got one for dt by d tau, and one for d phi by d tau. So we can combine those together to get a differential equation for dr by d tau. And that's what I do to get 3.11. Okay? So you can check that for yourself, but it's using an equation 2.14 that we had in the previous chapter. And that's what we have. So this is basically what we have to work with, equation 3.11. Well, it doesn't look particularly special as a differential equation. So the most meaningful way to proceed, and this is basically what Einstein did, is to try to compare that differential equation with what you would have if you just had Newtonian gravity, to try to see what difference GR has introduced. So we've got a small diversion now where we think about planetary orbits in Newtonian theory. And I've put this in quite brief but still explicit detail, because I recognise not everyone has done any of this stuff before. But those who did Astronomy 1, for example, well, it's all basically there in your Astronomy 1 Dynamical Astronomy course, but I realise that's a long time ago. So here's the basics. You might well have met this in physics courses too. So just to remind you, the Newtonian equations of motion would be as follows. Remember, again, in Newtonian classical physics, there's no need to worry about the distinction between coordinate time and proper time. Time is just assumed to be a universal concept that applies to every observer. And that's wrong, but we're looking at the Newtonian result, so that's what we have. So we do away with our tau and we just put t in, and we've got r squared d phi by dt equals a constant. Okay? Now those of you who have done astronomy before, or even maybe some who haven't, might otherwise recognise this as Kepler's second law, because it says that in an elliptical orbit, planets will sweep out equal areas in equal time. Okay? So that's essentially Kepler's law. And then the second equation is the equation of motion. So this is the equation you get when you balance centrifugal force, the sort of circular acceleration force, with the gravitational force. That's where equation 313 comes from. Okay. So we see immediately that that equation is different. I mean, it could maybe be made quite similar to equation 311 with a wee bit of substitution. We'll see how that all works in a minute. But it'd be kind of surprising if you get exactly the same solution, and sure enough you don't. So let's see what we get. Okay, the way that we proceed, the way that I certainly recommend you proceed, is that instead of trying to solve the differential equations in terms of r, we solve them in terms of a new variable u, which is 1 over r. So the first thing we've got to do is to change variables. So the equation for d phi by dt, which previously was equal to h over r squared, just down here, okay? When you change variables to replace r by u, that becomes d phi by dt equals h times u squared. That's the easy one. Changing variables in the other one involves the chain rule, but it's not too hard. And have a crack at this for yourself. What you find is that d2u by d phi squared is equal to minus u plus m over h squared. So that's what the equation 313 becomes when you replace r by u and t by phi. That's what you get. Now that is, again, in very compressed form, more or less what was covered in the Astronomy 1 Dynamical Astronomy course for those who've done it. And it's the equation of an ellipse. So this is the basis for Newton's realization that planetary orbits were ellipses. Okay? It's got solution, basically a constant, times 1 plus e cos phi. And that represents an ellipse with eccentricity e, semi-major axis a, which we'll relate to h in a minute, and focus at r equals 0. Now, what I've produced, and I apologise for not printing off your own personal copy to bring, but I'll bring some for next time and I'll put it on the Moodle site in the meantime, is just a little sort of crib sheet as to the properties of an ellipse. And I hope those who've done astronomy for a while will be a bit more familiar with this, but those who've not, well, you're probably less familiar. So just to recap, if you've got an ellipse, it's defined by its eccentricity, which is a measure basically of how flattened the ellipse is. An ellipse has two focal points, two foci, at F1 and F2, and the distance O to X is the semi-major axis, usually denoted by A. O to Y is the semi-minor axis, denoted by B, and A and B are related via the eccentricity. B squared is A squared into 1 minus E squared. And a point P on the ellipse is defined by the equation you see in the red box, which is a constant over 1 plus E cos phi. And remember, that's R, but we defined our change of variable R equals 1 over U, or U equals 1 over R. So this does match up with the expression you've just seen in the notes. And L is known as the semilatus rectum, which is a line that's perpendicular to the major axis of the ellipse, and it passes through the focal point. Okay? So if the ellipse is actually a circle, in which case the eccentricity is zero, then you'll see from this equation over here that b squared would equal a squared, or b equals a, in which case the semilatus rectum will just be a squared over a, which is a, i.e. the radius of the circle. But if it's not a circle, if the eccentricity is not equal to zero, then the ellipse is flattened, and the more flattened the ellipse is, then the smaller the semilatus rectum is. Okay? So, I'll put that in the Moodle site just as a kind of guide, a pictorial guide, to some of the geometric relations that we're going to use in the subsequent equations. Right. So any questions about ellipses based on that? That all look sort of vaguely familiar, or not exactly too taxing, even if you're not instantly familiar with it. Right. Well, let's see how we can use all that. Okay. So there we see we've got semilatus rectum in geometrical terms is just L equals A times 1 minus E squared. Okay? But if you look at the equation that we get from the dynamics, in Newtonian dynamics, then the semilatus rectum is H squared over M. So there is a connection between the physical parameter M and the sort of geometrical parameter L. So that's a Newtonian differential equation. It's an ellipse. How does the GR solution differ? Okay? So the advance of pericentered in GR. Well, let me just back up a minute to the equation that we got to. There's the equation that we got from the geodesic differential equation. So that's our starting point. Equation 311, dr by d tau squared equals a bunch of stuff. So what we want to see is, how does that differ from the Newtonian solution? Well, we found it simple to solve the Newtonian solution by converting from r to u and from t to theta, or t to phi. So we'll basically do the same for the GR solution and see what we get. Okay? So if we convert from r to u and from tau to phi, then what 311 turns into is equation 319. Okay? And I'm going to leave you to have a crack at that, because I think it's not desperately hard, but it's a very, very good way to check that you're comfortable doing the kinds of algebraic manipulation that you would have to do in an exam. Okay, but if anyone has any trouble deriving that expression, I think it is one of the example sheet questions, but if it's not, I'll check that, and of course I'm happy to go through it with you. Alright, so let's assume you can get 319. Where do you go from there? Well, the Newtonian expression we had involved a second derivative of u. Okay, remind you again where we've got. There it is there. Equation 316, d2u by d phi squared. So we want to get something like that for the GR solution. So what we do is we take 319 that involves du by d phi, and we differentiate it again. Okay? So we differentiate it again and we cancel the common factor of du by d phi. Now the mathematical purists would worry a bit. If du by d phi is 0, then we've not really got any business cancelling it from both sides of an equation. But actually, it's okay. You can sort of get away with it just about, in the sense that you can set du by d phi equal to some small quantity, and kind of in the limit where that quantity tends to 0, the equation still checks out. But in case anyone's worrying about doing this, well, put it this way. Du by d phi would be 0 if it was a perfectly circular orbit. So strictly speaking, you should only be allowed to do this cancellation if you allow for the general elliptical orbit. But the algebra of the general elliptical orbit is a lot messier. So if you get a question in the exam, the chances are it's going to be a circular orbit, because I want to make your life easy. So I don't want, as a result of that, to get some comments like, what are you doing dividing by 0 on both sides? Cancelling a common factor of 0, accept it that in the spirit of us making the exam question doable in half an hour, that we cut the odd small mathematical corner. But just in case anybody picks up on that, in the example sheets you'll see there's some examples where that's done, and indeed if you're looking at past papers you'll see the same trick. Okay. So assuming we are allowed to cancel common factors even if they're 0, then what we get is equation 320. We get d2u by d phi squared equals minus u plus m over 8 squared plus 3m u squared. So let's see if we can get both equations on the same page. We possibly can, but only if we make them smaller. So let's just do that for a moment. There we are. So we've got 316 at the top. Those at the back can get the binoculars out. And we've got 320 at the bottom. And you can see that the only difference is the extra term, 3mu squared. Okay? So that is what all the fuss is about. That's the difference between GR and Newtonian dynamics, is that extra term. So, the effect of the GR treatment is to add that extra term, 3mu squared on the right hand side. Our next task is to work out what effect that has. So we're going to work out the impact of the extra term on a planet moving around a star of mass m. We'll see that the size of that extra term is really tiny. Therefore, you might think, ah, well, it's not going to have any effect at all. But when you solve the differential equation, it has a cumulative effect because it introduces a term that just keeps on growing over time. So let's see how that happens. So first of all, if we look at the size of the extra term, 3mu squared, and divide it by the size of the term that's there in both GR and the Newtonian theory, which is m over 8 squared, okay, if you do a bit of cancellation, what that winds up as is 3 8 squared times u squared. Now 8 squared, if we trace this back, is L times M, where L is the semi-latus rectum, which, because the Earth's orbit is pretty much circular, L is equal to the radius of the Earth's orbit. So 8 squared is one astronomical unit times the mass of the Sun for the Earth. Okay? So if you plug in all those numbers, then what you wind up with is that 3mu squared over m over 8 squared is approximately 3 times 10 to the minus 8. It's a dimensionless term and it's very, very small. So you might think it's going to have no effect at all. We'll see in a moment that that's not true, but at the very least, we would expect that at any given time, the effect is small. So that means that we can derive a solution in the following way. What we do is we take the GR solution, or the GR equation that we're trying to solve, okay, which is 320, and we say, okay, let's do the following. Let's say that the GR solution that we want is equal to the Newtonian solution plus just a small extra piece. We assume that that extra piece is small. And the way we work out what it is that we set this term over here, which should really be UGR, whatever the solution is for the full GR equation, but we just replace it in the extra term by U Newtonian, the expression for the Newtonian solution. Okay? So we've replaced u in the u squared term on the right hand side by the solution to the Newtonian version of this equation. So that means that we are missing a small extra piece in that final term. But since the final term is already 10 to the minus 8 times smaller than the second term, it's presumably not going to matter too much if we've lost a little part of it. Okay? So the approximate equation that we're trying to solve, but it's a very good approximation, is equation 322. So what we've done there is we've taken the 3mu squared term and we've replaced u squared by u Newtonian squared, the solution to the Newtonian equation, which was just an ellipse. So that's given us 322. And we're going to write that as the sum of a Newtonian and a GR part. So UGR describes the correction. Yeah, just reading my own notes. Makes sense, I thought I'd got it wrong there. UGR describes the correction to the Newtonian orbit. Okay? So if we think what the Newtonian part was, the Newtonian part was d2u by d phi squared equals minus u plus m over 8 squared. So if we write minus u as minus u Newtonian plus UGR, then we can subtract off the Newtonian solution, and d2 by d phi squared, that's a linear operator, so we can do the same there. We can write d2 by d phi squared into u Newtonian plus ugr, and then we can subtract off the Newtonian solution. What we're left with is equation 324. So the GR correction satisfies a second order differential equation described by 324. It is an approximation, but it's an extremely good one. It's to sort of at the level of 1 part in 10 to the 8. Okay? Now, we can do a little bit of further simplification, and it's really a bit dull stuff. It's just replacing trigonometric identities. This is one of those ones that you probably learn in first year and maybe don't use very much thereafter, that you can write cos squared of phi as a half into 1 minus cos 2 phi. Okay, so I've done that substitution, and that gets rid of the e squared cos squared phi term, and that winds up appearing in equation 326 as shown. So equation 326 has right hand side a plus b cos phi plus c cos 2 phi. And to make our life easier, instead of working through the solution, I'm just going to give us a solution and we can verify that it does in fact turn out to be a solution. Okay? So the right hand side takes that form, and particular integrals for each of these terms are given by equations 328, 329 and 330. Okay? So that means, if you remember all this stuff from when you've done differential equations in math, if you add together those three particular integrals, then that is your general solution. So basically, the three terms are a constant, which is tiny. The UGR, the third term, is a constant, which is also tiny, that's minus the third c, multiplied by cos 2 phi, which is just going to oscillate between minus 1 and plus 1. The one that's the real interesting term is the second, UGR equals a half b phi sine phi. So that's a small constant, b is again of order, you know, really small numbers, but it's multiplied by phi. And phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, and then it just goes from 2 pi to 4 pi, and it just keeps on increasing. Okay, that's then multiplied by sine phi, so sometimes sine phi will be 0, but the cumulative effect as phi keeps on increasing is that sometimes that second term will be large, because phi can just keep on growing ad infinitum. Okay? So, to summarise, we add a completely negligible constant, an equally negligible constant plus a tiny sort of cosine wiggle, but the second term is what's called a secular term that just keeps on growing, and ultimately will have a non-negligible effect. So what we do is we ignore the first and the third. We say, right, let's forget about those. It's the second term which contributes. So let us see what happens if we work through that. Okay, so let me just back up a minute to let you see how far we've got. So remember, the particular solution that we're interested in is the GR correction. Okay? So the GR correction is added on to the Newtonian solution. So our full solution is the Newtonian plus the GR correction. So let's see what we've got. Okay, maybe I should use the big stick for this. So equation 331, the first part there, that's the Newtonian solution. Okay? And then the second part is the correction, except that we've thrown away the bits of the correction which are negligible, because actually they don't make any difference. The only part of the correction that we've included is the second of the three particular integral terms, which is the UGR equals a half b phi sine phi. because, as I said, that one will just keep on growing, because phi can be unbounded. It can just keep on growing. Okay? And I've explicitly put in what B is, which hopefully you can see if you look back at where the notes lead you, that we get a 3m squared over 8 squared. Now, 3m squared over 8 squared is very small, and we know that for a very small angle, cos of that angle is approximately 1, and sine of that angle is just approximately the angle. So I used yet another bit of trigonometric magic to simplify equation 331. What I'm doing is I'm taking the e cos phi term and the e phi sine phi term, and I'm doing a bit of simplification. And it's possible to show that you can recast 331 in the form of 333. That's another bit of algebra that you should check you can do, and let me know if you can't. And you'll see that that's been a past paper question a few times in the past, because this is really the key result. This is us deriving an expression for u, which is 1 over r, in terms of essentially an elliptical expression. It looks like an ellipse. It looks just like an ellipse, except that we've now got this extra piece, the 1 minus 3m squared over 8 squared. So the Newtonian expression is u equals m over 8 squared into 1 plus e cos phi. The GR expression is u equals m over 8 squared into 1 plus e cos phi, if you like, phi dash, where phi dash equals 1 minus 3m squared over 8 squared times phi. So it's as if we've got an ellipse, but the rate at which the angle is increasing is changed from the Newtonian expression. Okay? And that means, since the angle is still defined by phi, effectively, the period is changed. Okay? Because the values of r trace out an approximate ellipse, but they don't begin to repeat themselves. You don't get back to the same value of r, not 2 pi later, but a bit more than 2 pi later, because you've got to wait for the term in the brackets here to kind of catch up. Okay? So the Newtonian expression's got period 2 pi, but this thing, equation 333, has got period 2 pi over 1 minus 3m squared over 8 squared. That's greater than 2 pi. Okay? They don't begin to repeat the values of r until after the radius vector has made a full revolution. So figure 1 shows that the pericenter advances by an amount delta, which we can calculate. What we do is we calculate it on the following basis. We calculate the actual period, we subtract 2 pi, which would be the periodicity of a fixed ellipse, and the difference between those two is the extra bit that the ellipse is moved on by every rotation. Okay? So we can rewrite that as 6 pi m squared over 8 squared. If you can see how I've done that, this is 1 minus a small thing to the power minus 1, so that's approximately 1 plus the small thing. Okay, it's using a Taylor series expansion. Okay? So we wind up with, at long last, that delta is 6 pi m over a into 1 minus e squared. That's how much you gain every orbit. And if you apply equation 335 to the orbit of Mercury, you get 43 seconds of arc per century, which is a tiny amount, but it's still measured. And this was the first major success of GR, because it was the first time that anyone could explain a small discrepancy in the orbit of Mercury, which had bothered astronomers for quite a while. Now remember, we've derived a solution by comparing the GR prediction with the Newtonian solution, but the Newtonian solution for us was the easiest form of Newtonian solution you can get. It was the Newtonian solution for the Sun and one single planet. In actual fact, in our solar system, of course, there's more than that. So Mercury's orbit, even in the Newtonian picture, would precess, because the orbit would be perturbed by the other planets. So before GR came along, most of you probably know this, perhaps, if you know a bit about the history of relativity, what astronomers thought the explanation for Mercury's precession was that there was an extra planet adding a bit of extra perturbation that no one had discovered yet. So astronomers worked out where that planet had to be in order to produce the extra perturbation to explain Mercury's orbit. They even gave it a name, they called it Vulcan. If only they'd been Star Trek fans, they would have realised where Vulcan really was. In their view, Vulcan had to be on an orbit inside that of Mercury. But of course, it turns out that there was no such planet. It was because they were trying to solve the wrong equation. And if you like, you can draw kind of analogies that the mass of Vulcan that in a Newtonian classical description they kind of invented to explain Mercury's orbit. Instead, really, it's the sort of energy associated with the curvature of space-time itself which plays the role of that extra mass. I mean, that's a perfectly fair way to look at it. I prefer just to say, well, look, you work out the geodesic equations and it just turns out that that's what Mercury's orbit ought to be. But if you want to hook that onto a kind of physical explanation of what's going on, then think of it in terms of the space-time curvature adding effectively some extra mass to solve the equation, an extra perturbation to Mercury's orbit. Okay? So, you know, it's pretty heavy stuff, this. There's a lot of math to go through, but it is a very important result, and indeed, it was one of the key things that convinced people that general relativity was correct. So just a few minutes left, let me sort of pause for breath and see if there's any questions so far. I mean, I've hit a lot of algebra in your direction today, but I do encourage you to try to go through these equations for yourself and make sure you can see how it fits together. Okay, the derivation of the result from start to finish would never be the sort of question you would expect to get, you know, to do the whole lot. But for example, just to let you see kind of where this might cross your radar, one of the 10 marker questions for GRG a few years ago, I think if I remember rightly, what I did was I gave people that expression and then asked them to show that it reduced to this much perihelion advance. But what I also asked them to do was to work out for an extra solar planet system that had recently been discovered how much of a perihelion advance or periastron advance that would represent. And it was one of the systems that have got a lot of publicity. They're called hot Jupiters, massive planets which are even closer to their star than Mercury is to our Sun. So therefore they'll undergo even more precession. But it's still not very much. Fraction of a degree per century. If you really want to see a lot of precession, then you need much stronger gravity. You need something like the binary pulsar system or OJ287. Okay, I won't bother reading the text, you can all read that for yourself, but let me just highlight the key phrases, which is that the binary pulsar system, which was first discovered in 74, processes at more than 4 degrees per year. Okay, and OJ287, which is an example of an active galactic nucleus, and I'll talk about those in the galaxies course for those who still to get that. Well, it's believed to be a binary supermassive black hole system. One of them has a mass of about 18 billion solar masses. It's the biggest supermassive black hole we've ever found, to date at least. And the smaller one orbits with a period of about 12 years, and it precesses by more than 30 degrees every orbital period. So these are massive effects, and basically, unless GR's right, then the observations we make of these systems just wouldn't make sense. The companion objects for the binary pulsar system and OJ287 and other examples, the companion object just isn't where it's supposed to be if Newtonian gravity is correct. Okay? So, let me just end with a couple of pictures. Oh, I should also mention, we'll get to this in subsequent weeks, but the semi-major axis for these sorts of systems is also shrinking. And we believe that's because they're radiating gravitational waves. But we'll come back to that later. Let me just finish off with a couple more pictures. So there's your sort of classic idea of the precessing ellipse. It's figure one that you've got in the notes anyway. There's figure two that shows the total amount of precession of Mercury's orbit. But most of that can be explained by the perturbating effects of the other planets. But there's an additional 43 arcseconds that requires GR. And there is Russell Hulse and Joe Taylor, who won the Nobel Prize for their observations of the binary pulsar system, both the fact that the orbit precesses and also the fact that it's shrinking because of, we think, the radiation of gravitational waves. So very strong evidence. And then this is really hot off the press. It was only April 2008, so it was after the last time I taught GR, this system OJ287. Not so much that it was discovered, it had been known about for a while, but the orbit wasn't known well enough to determine if it really was precessing or not. But it is, and it's big news in the GR community, because every time the companion with 100 million solar masses passes through the accretion disk around the really massive one, then you get a flare, sort of some X-ray emission. So that's how we can map the orbit pretty well. And the orbit isn't doing what Newtonian physics would predict. It's doing what GR would predict. So Einstein wins again. Okay? Right, we'll stop there. And next time we're going to talk about gravitational lensing. So you can read ahead if you've got the time. Thanks.